Well, thank you. Oh, thank you for those who hang out to at the end. I don't know how well I fit. I have kind of a very different take on things. This is a little bit of psychology meets education theory, instructional practice, with touching on epistemology, theology, and stuff like that. All of which has almost nothing to do with my formal training as a solid-state physicist. So I want to give a little background why I think I have anything to say about that. After doing my doctorate, I took a postdoctoral fellowship in physics education, and in my subdiscipline of physics that's focused on how students learn physics or not learn physics, and in that context, most people are what we might call a working out of some sort of constructivist framework, whether it's resources, misconceptions, or things like that, including a little bit from the social cultural constructivist perspective. That's where I encountered that. Not very common. It's work based on some of the ideas of Lev Vygotsky, who, among other things, was a very much an anti-reductionist. And you can imagine how that sits real well with a lot of physicists, because we tend to be eponyms of reductionists. So I want to probably need to start out with thinking about what is, do I mean by constructivism? And in a good constructivist fashion, I'd like to ask you this question. Specifically, I like to do a think, pair, share, like I do with my students. This means take a moment, think about the question, what would you answer to this question, then get together with somebody, and that might mean some of you may have to move so you can have somebody to talk to, because I like to get you to get together with one or two other people and discuss this for a moment or two, and then I'll collect a few of ideas, okay? We understand your assignment? Okay, think about this. Talk it over a phone moment, and let me get some collect your ideas. Okay. Okay. Could I bring you all together? And since we only have a few groups, could someone from each group tell us briefly what you all talked about?
Okay. We think that constructivism is an active eclectic process of improving our epistemic status.
Okay. A lot of big words in there. And I'm going to be touching on some of those things. Thank you.
We think it has something to do with system building, theory building, or worldview
constructing. Okay. Constructing, that's good ideas. You all?
Well, we just said that we thought it meant building up sort of the tools of the discipline from things already inside the student.
Okay. So I've got some ideas from you. Let me tell you a little bit of what I think about in constructivism. First, I'll tell you what it's not. In my discipline, we tend to set up probably a little bit of a straw man. We're not transmissionists. It's not about taking information and sticking it in the student's head, okay? That is not what learning consists of, because learning is not a mere acquisition of information. It's not downloading information onto a computer, because there are processes involved. I would submit to you that this is more than a problem of communication. This dog looks pretty friendly. Doesn't seem to see there's any problem. This dog has constructed a different understanding of what that phrase means, and a different understanding of what that relationship is between him and the stuff and his owner. That information comes in, and we have to do something with that. And one of the things in cognitive science, people have long studied learning in cognitive science, is that what matters is not just information, but how that is assembled in the mind. And one of the differences between, say, a novice physics student and a expert physics problem solver, and this was actually a study of research in the 70s, starting in cognitive science, is not just the amount of information they have, but how it is connected in the student's mind. And so we might think of a representation of a novice's ideas about physics, and this is not a physics talk, I just teach physics, so of course those ideas are up there. You know, he's got some different ideas, there's no real organization, there's some connections between some of them, whereas if we take an expert's picture, would be not only there's more, but there's a web of connections. And so this person can go from the forces and can trace through this web of connections until they find the information they need in a situation. Have you ever had a situation where you know something, but you can't remember it? And as a constructivist, I would say that's because you don't have the connections between where you are mentally at this point and where that information resides in your brain, that you aren't able to follow through the paths to that point. And part of the idea is that in constructivism, we all construct our own internal mental models of the reality that we find ourselves in, where this is, in my teaching, models of physical reality in terms of how physics works, or a theology, or anything like this. And this is not something that I can take my model out of my head and stick it in my students' brains, that they have to construct it individually. A picture might be a ship in a bottle. It's a representation of something out there, but it's inside this bottle. And unless some sort of magic was worked, someone had to somehow assemble pieces inside this bottle to make it work. So one of the consequences of constructivism and generalism, before I get that, I need to put a disclaimer. Sometimes, and I've heard people take and reject against constructivism, there is a pushback in some areas of educational theory against this, because you take the stream and it gets ridiculous, like a lot of things. And where the focus becomes on the constructive models oneself, and so the focus in instruction is helping students develop their abilities to construct models. Ultimately, this leads to a relativistic epistemology. The truth is relative, that we all have our own models, and your model is good as anything. I reject that as a physicist, as a scientist who believes in a reality, and as a Christian who believes in there is a God and who there is one who knows absolute truth. All our understandings of truth are some approximation to that, but there is one who has absolute truth. Instead, we're focusing on constructing models of external reality, and my goal as an instructor is not to help my students develop their ability to construct mental models, but to help them construct the mental model that best represents reality, or in practicality in my classroom, best closely resembles my mental model, since Presumably, with all my years of physics, I learned something and I have somewhat better ideas about that. And this fits very well with a correspondence epistemology that we're looking for the best correspondence between that external reality and this internal model, which fits very much with what we do in science. There's the external reality, there's our theories, and we try to fit them. And, you know, as a Christian, recognizing the fallenness of human nature, this affects things. And we don't have, there are mysteries, there are things we cannot grasp entirely, but we can work towards that. So consequences for teaching, learning is an active process. You don't construct models passively. You have to actively take this information in and process that. The current knowledge and beliefs shape learning. If you've already got one sort of knowledge structure and I bring some new information, you're going to connect that in differently than someone who might have a different understanding. You need multiple direction communication. We have to think about metacognition. If you don't notice, that's what I just did with you all. I was interested in what was your previous knowledge. I asked you, what do you think about constructivism? I wanted to bring that in. Are there some issues we need to do? I asked you to actively talk about this and participate, and several of you had to move around to do this. Active learning. We had multiple directional communication between peers with me, back forth and stuff. And we talked about what we were doing. We were paying attention to the metacognition. Now, this is general constructivism. What I'm interested in talking to you is about social cultural constructivism. And I think I didn't say it clearly. Where I'm going with this is, as I've been getting to this, I've been finding this is a very useful framework for thinking about some of the issues in science and faith communication and in some of the looking at Genesis in terms of origins. And that's why I wanted to share with you why I think this is relevant for this audience. Social cultural constructivism draws... I'm getting ahead of myself. Another example, something I oftentimes do with my students in teaching physics problem solving. We really like problem solving in physics, for better or for worse. I want to ask you what you feel about that. But we'll do cooperative group solving, get a group of three students, and they'll give them a problem. And this will be a challenging real-life problem, much more complex than a typical end-of-the-chapter problem, paragraph-long story, may have extraneous information, multiple steps, and things like that. So it's a really difficult problem. They're worked on together as a group. They only have one sheet to work on, so they have to talk about it and they have to discuss it out. I'm going around like a chicken with a head cut off, trying to help people get unstuck because they get stuck multiple times. And this problem-solving sheet has a template that follows the explicit problem-solving strategy that I've talked about. We have active learning. We have multi-directional communication. We're thinking about metacognition, whether steps of problem-solving. And so this is a constructivist thing. Now, I was starting to talk about Lev Vygotsky, and Russian development psychologist, died 80 years ago, just before Stalin's repressions started. His ideas were suppressed under Stalin. His ideas have only been made, came known to the West in around the 1980s and 90s and stuff like that. So it's still kind of working itself into general educational theory. Founded in the cultural historical theory. And as I've been reading and learning about this, I really like some of the things that he does. And some of the ideas he has about this. So what are some of the key ideas of his theories? Makes big emphasis on the role of symbol and language in thought. Talks about symbol as the tools of thought, just like a plow is a tool of agriculture. Symbols, whether it is tying a knot in a handkerchief or written language or other sorts of things, are tools of thought. That they are essential for developing higher order mental processes. That if you don't master, this is part of being human, is the ability to create these symbols that represent things. And so we freeze us from a stimulus response. We now have tools for controlling how we respond to a particular stimulus. and the meanings are dynamic. I'll talk a lot about speech and how he claims that thought is internalized speech. That without speech, you can't really develop the ability to thought. It's linked to the context, history, motivation, emotional. You can see why he's not a reductionist. It's all connected in his things. And it's an essential part of human development. He talks about one child that grew up in an area with kind of two different languages, never mastered one of them, and was incapable of any sort of abstract thought. And he claims this because not developing the speech. Another social cultural things really emphasize that the culture and history and the social context are really important. The symbol and language are rooted in both a personal history and a cultural history. And so the history of your culture shapes how you think, how you speak. Context strongly shapes learning and development. His claim was that for the symbol and language will also shape culture, and learning and development of the individual is a negotiation between personal experience and the social context of this, which tends to be ignored by a lot of development psychologists. Last area, and probably what he's best known of, my daughter brings home sheets that talk about zone of proximal development, and he, for the learning, he divided things into three areas. There's the area that the learner is able to do it independently without any assistance, area that they could do things with some assistance, and that without. For example, a student who has mastered addition, a first grader who's mastered addition, multiplication could be, that's in the first zone, multiplication would be in the zone of proximal development. Not able to do it independently, but with a little assistance, the student could do a mathematics problem. Teaching this person calculus is beyond their ability to do it without any assistance, even with assistance. But one of the key ideas of his things is not only is you doing, but by working in the zone of proximal development, you actually spur development of the student's ability and knowledge, and so you expand the zone of proximal development to the point where you think new things become within the reachable area, and really advocated you need to be working in this challenging area. So where does that connect to science and faith? And I'll have to run through a little bit. I'll talk about cooperative problem solving, got symbols, discussion of problems, that discussion between students. I want them to internalize that into their internal discussion when they talk problems. Group table interactions, social context. They're at round tables, working in groups. Beyond their ability to solve independently, but with support they can solve it. We're working in that zone of proximal development. Now, science and faith. I'll run through this quickly, but one of the things it really emphasizes, and I'm sure this is not a lot of new for most of you, but it's a theoretical thing, words and symbols merely matter. And different ideas, beliefs, and emotions are associated with words. A evolution biologist and a fundamentalist preacher are going to attach different meaning to the word evolution. And we have to be aware of that. As we are in science have developed a certain way. We've been enculturated into a scientific culture. We have learned to think in a certain way. Our scientific language spurs us to think in a certain way. That's not true of someone who has grown up in this religious background, environment, used to religious language, but not the scientific. And so there's this translation. And there's a lot of talk about dialogue. I'll move on. Recognize we've been socialized into cultural groups. We talked about there's a cultural history to scientific language, to religious language. Personal social identity are important. I'm not going to take risky things and go off and to start believing in climate change as everybody in my church is questioning it, because that's really important in those relationships. Change takes time. that you can't necessarily take someone from one position to another position right away, that you have to sometimes have to go through multiple stages of that. Now I'm going to move right along because particularly thinking about some things about Genesis. It's a form of a narrative, reflects ancient ideas about cosmos, some ancient motifs like very recent creation, fully formed by the divinity, humans made from the ground, which tends to conflict with some of the modern scientific ideas about that. So you can ask the question, why would God use these ancient motifs, cosmology and stuff, to communicate divine truth? I'm of the opinion that this is a cultural communication of divine theological truth. Why would he do that? Well, past year I read Kenneth Sparks' survey of ancient literature, and one of the things that struck me is he talks about how they did not have systematic dialogue, discourse at that time, like essays. And so if they wanted to talk about a philosophical or theological issue, very often it was in the form of a narrative. And so why this has several implications. One, God could not have used an essay to talk to people about that the creation at that time because that was not in their culture. But it also shapes thought patterns. So actually I'm talking about this. Systematic discourse really started with Aristotle and the Greeks. And so I would submit by Vygotsky's ideas that previous to Aristotle, people did not have the capacity to think in the analytical, systematic way that we tend to think. Not because they were less intelligent, but they did not have Aristotle in their cultural heritage. And they did not inherit those tools to that. Another thing goes on is a lot of the symbols, a lot of the motifs, sacrificial practice and stuff were very similar to the surrounding culture, but God changes the meaning in Genesis. He changes the meaning of that. So instead of trying to eradicate those old symbols and then fighting with the people going back to them, he takes those symbols and he changes the meaning so they can't go back to that old theology. He was communicating in the first audience's cultural setting. The goal was not to inform the people the details of how God did it. Genesis is part of the Pentateuch, and the goal of the Pentateuch is to establish a covenant people. And the goal was social, cultural transformation into a covenant people. And a lot of this is focused on developing a social, cultural identity as a covenant people in doing this. And Genesis is part of that. It needs to be understood as part of that. And lastly, to talk about development, the goal was social development was critical with the theology, not so much the ideas about the cosmos, because before you can reveal the Trinity, you have to have really understand something about the unity of God. Otherwise, it's just another version of polytheism. Before you can really start to comprehend the mystery of the incarnation, you have to grasp something about the otherness of God. Otherwise, Jesus is just some other half-God, demigod like Hercules, who is a great story but doesn't save us. And so I'm now seeing Genesis as a first step towards this. So what I'd answer my question with? He did it because he's a wise teacher who understood these pedagogical principles. And he was working with them, starting the process of developing a covenant people that could eventually receive the full revelation in Jesus Christ. And I think I'll stop right there and ask if there are any questions. Yes.
I'm interested in how can you use this I don't know if your students are Christians or some of them are Christians, to help them with thinking through for themselves physics and integrative issues with physics.
Like physics and science and?
Physics and faith.
Physics and faith. That's a big question. I think one of the things is to recognize that, you know, physics has a language. Faith has a language. They have different languages. We approach them in different ways. And these are embedded in cultural contexts. And also to recognize that there is, what I want to say, that each of these is a construct, it's some approximation to reality, and so even though there, in our minds there's a conflict, that's not necessarily conflict, it's because we have these only partial type of things. And in physics we have this, you know, people working on theory of ultimate things, because quantum mechanics and general relativity are incompatible. And so we as physicists know that there's got to be, there, neither of those is the final story. And I would claim any of our human understanding is not the final story. Does that help address? Yes?
Let me ask, when you read scripture, you read about stories, you don't read about facts or propositions or formulas. Mm-hmm. Does that notion in terms of teaching fit into the framework?
Well, one of the things is when you read, you're reading a writing that's in a particular genre. And the author is working in a particular genre, and each genre has its rules of how you present things and what is the central, what is the focus, and stuff like that. And I think you have to reapproach every text in understanding, you know, what is the goal and stuff like that. And I actually, in my real work, I'm working right now on teaching technical writing in the laboratory. I'm giving a presentation tomorrow in Minneapolis about that. And so you have to understand, and for a particular genre, you need to understand that. And one of the things that I think that happens is the culture in the literary genre and the thinking approaches of the original audience of Genesis are so different from ours that we sometimes have a hard time understanding it. You know, and I think that's what John Woolton was addressing in his workshop on Friday, that you have to start understanding something about that cultural context before you really can really appreciate the message. Now, I would say that in the Bible, the central message is clear. You don't need that. The central message in Genesis 1 is God did it. But to really understand the details and to really appreciate that passage. And for me, this realization has really helped me to be able to appreciate Genesis 1. For a long time, I had this uneasiness about that. But now that I look at it, this is God speaking absolutely perfect divine truth into their cultural context, knowing their limitations, knowing where they needed to go, and just appreciate that it is a phenomenal, in that context, it is a wonderful assertion of monotheism in contrast to the paganism of the surrounding cultures.